So when you're a child, David, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, goodness. What did I want to be when I grew up? I had lots of them. At one point I wanted to be a doctor. I think actually that might have been fun. Now I look back and go, well, it'd be kind of good to have those credentials, but not that I particularly miss them. At one point I was thinking of being an architect, and I've always had a strong science streak, so that was, I went off to university taking every science in the book until I realized that science in high school was about things and interesting stuff happening, and science in university was all about mathematics. So that lasted me about 2 weeks, and then I quit. So the other side, of course, of me was that I was an artist, and that was what I was doing when I ran into the Alexander Technique.
So how did you know you were any good at this Alexander Technique stuff?
Well, you know, that's a funny question, actually. I think everybody goes through it. It was, for me, it was more that I was interested in, it wasn't about how good I was, it was how good the work was. You know, how much effect it had on me and how much effect it had on people around, and a certain perception you have when you run into something that just seems to have a truth about it, that it seems to go very deep and very profound. And so to me it's always been more about going for that rather than the skill or the, I suppose we all do our best at whatever it is we're doing, but if it has that depth and profundity, then we're just kind of tapping into that. And, you know, as a teacher, I'm not trying to get people to see about the Alexander Technique or my skill or those principles, because it's really about them. It's really about our human nature and how we work and how we don't work. The technique is, if you like, perhaps only the medium that one uses to get at that, or rather a particular formulation of what it is that goes on in people. Somewhat different than another formulation by somebody else about what goes on in people. And the thing that's always kind of interested me is the difference, I suppose, in not so much between all the different works, but I'd say the difference between those who are kind of going right to the source, whose interest in what happens with people. Why do we have these problems? What is our nature? And, you know, that kind of thing on the one hand, and the people that are interested in the method on the other hand, and don't always see the connection with the actual people. That is, they'll elaborate the method and go into that regardless of whether it matches what happens with people or not. And of course this isn't just the Alexander Technique I'm talking about, but any method where the method starts to become the goal rather than the window through which you're looking at the people.
When did you realize that the technique was going to be a lifetime pursuit for you?
I don't think I've ever realized that. In fact, I wouldn't even say that now, but because again, I think it goes back to the biggest realization was when I kind of recognized that that direction for me, which happened in the beginning to be embodied with the Alexander Technique, that direction of interest in what really goes on for people, as opposed to before in my own psyche with my art or in you know, other sorts of things, but when I really began to be interested in what happens with people, initially myself, you know, where were my problems, what was going on there, and tapping into really recognizing, because I see that I think the central thing with the Alexander Technique, at least for me, and I recognize this is not how a lot of people view it, but is that premise, I guess you could call it. I don't think it has an actual name in it so much. Maybe psychophysical unity comes close enough, but that premise that we have an innate wholeness and integration that is part of our basic nature, except to the degree that we've interfered with it. So if that's true, if underlying it, and that was kind of the first big insights that really struck me as with the depth and profoundness was, holy crap, you know, we're not damaged, we're not poorly evolved, we don't have a system that has lots of problems, and we need to overlay a new skill or technique or conscious control or modern way of dealing with our ancient somewhat flawed system. We actually have an amazing system. Most of us don't know it, and we've been abusing it and misusing it and misunderstanding it left, right, and center. But when we manage to find those interferences and take them away, then bingo, out comes these glorious moments of presentness and centeredness and wholeness and calmness and all those characteristics that exist when you have those lovely, what would you call them, good juice moments, good wholeness moments. And I think it took me a while to kind of really see that as not so much a goal to be after, but as our basic nature. I think it originally came up for me more as a question, you know, do we really have that? Could that be, is that a result of the Alexander technique or the hands-on, or is that actually what it means to say, oh, that's good use? And is that really there in all of us? I mean, short of actual real damage or, you know, some abnormal state, but is that our underlying state, except for the degree to which we, in various ways, physically, spatially, mentally, emotionally, and so on, interfere with it? Because if so, then that's absolutely fantastic. That means we have that, and all we have to do is get rid of the interferences, and then we're back home, as it were. The alternative one is that we don't have that. We are somehow evolved too quickly or poorly, or we have flaws or original sin or, you know, whatever the way you'd frame that, and we're not really that well suited for here, which is why we have all these problems and why we tend to degenerate over time. And what we need is a whole new kind of conscious functioning that we need to bring in to keep ourselves on track, but we're probably going to have to keep doing that for the rest of our lives, or we'll go off track again.
How has the Alexander technique affected the way you related with other people?
Presumably you're meaning how was the effect of studying the work and the changes that happened in me, how that changed me. Is that more?
Yeah, within the context of relating to other people.
Well, I suppose, and probably most everybody could say this to some degree, is it brought me back to myself. So I felt more centered, more me. It was part of a discovery of me, I guess, taking off all the things that I was doing to cope and to try and kind of be okay physically in the moment, in posture, in all kinds of other stuff. As that fell away and I just went, okay, this is just me, then everything gets a lot easier in terms of interaction. I think the other thing that happens probably a lot with anybody getting into any kind of sort of conscious work where they're looking at themselves and looking at change for the better, is you're tending to be hanging around with people that are doing the same. So, you know, in a sense, you're meeting the nicest people, the ones who are looking at themselves, who are wanting to change, and who are wanting to help other people. So you're actually meeting different people.
When did you start your teacher training in the technique?
I started having lessons in 1972 with the only teacher in Canada. And after a couple of years, and especially when I had a lot of big physical effects on myself and was beginning to realize the depth of it, I decided I'd like to train in it. So I wrote off to the only three schools that I knew existed at the time, which were the McDonald, Carrington, and Barlow schools in London. As it turned out, there was one in America, but I didn't know about it at the time. Actually, I think there were two or three in America at that point. But, anyway, they all wrote back and said, no, sorry, we're all full up, we have no space. So I sort of forgot about it for a while, and then about a year and a half, 2 years later, I got a letter out of the blue from Dillis Carrington saying, we have a space for you in 6 months if you want to come. And I wrote back and said, well, nah, sorry, I've been getting into my art now, and anyway, no, I don't think so. And then I started to think about it for a bit. A week or two went by, and I thought, gee, this is my chance to go to the continent and see all the art galleries. And I had some money because I'd sold some pictures that would last me for a while, and I could always quit if I didn't like it and come home. So I called her up on the very day she got my letter and said, I'm coming. So I went off and trained at Carrington's starting in late 77, actually early 78, January 78, and finished in 1980.
Okay, so let me ask you some questions about that. Did you have any second thoughts during the training about what you're doing?
No, I didn't, because I was... it was a pretty much, I think, a golden period there at Carrington's, with a lot of interesting things happening and a lot of interesting people. It was kind of the end of the period when a lot of the old teachers who trained with Alexander were in there teaching every day. Peggy Williams was a regular teacher, and Sydney Holland, and Cree Akers, who didn't train with Alexander, but she was there. So there were some fantastic teachers. And the students who were there at that time, many of them went on to start trainings in themselves, you know, of their own. Michael Frederick and, I can't remember all the names now, John Nichols, Chris Stevens, and there were two or three others whose names have probably come to me at the moment. But so there was some very interesting stuff happening there, but also within about the first year, because I had a anatomy background. I had studied anatomy for my art. I had done dissection, and Don Burton was teaching. He trained at Carrington's. He was teaching the anatomy there, and he and I started to do some workshops together. He was a fantastic anatomy teacher, but an absolutely abysmal drawer. And even I, who knew a lot, couldn't figure out his drawings, so I offered to do the drawings for him if he'd do all the talking. And so we started to do workshops together for Alexander teachers and on the training course. And then he left when I was near the end of my first year. He left to start his own training course. And Walter Carrington asked me if I would carry on doing the anatomy lectures at that school. And I was also teaching with Don at his school one day a week. And then when I got together with... another person who was already a teacher, Karen Wentworth, we started doing workshops in Europe with Don Burton, and then with in America with the very first of the Claymont workshops with Michael and Lena Frederick and Frank Sheldon, and Karen and I, we started those and started to do those every year. So during the course of my training, I was also doing a lot of teaching, a lot of workshops, a lot of lecturing at various schools. So it wasn't just going to the training course for me, and that was all very exciting on the one hand, and interesting, and huge benefit in developing my pedagogical skills. Because in those days, at least in the European trainings, there was really no practice teaching. You had your fellow students you worked with, but you didn't ever actually work with anybody, you know, a real student, or do any leading any classes. But so by the time I graduated in 1980, I'd had a huge amount of practical experience teaching, running groups, working with hundreds of students, from new ones to fairly practiced ones, and had taught in probably half a dozen or more training courses before I even became a teacher.
How did you learn about the various schools of the Alexander technique, the various styles, and how were you taught to regard the other styles?
Well, again, I probably had a fairly unique experience because of the anatomy stuff I did. I was invited to teach at a lot of schools. So I had a sort of inside view of them that a lot of people who came from one style, if you like, probably would not have had. I've done teaching in Misha Magidoff's school and several others, and of course Don Burton's and Carrington's, and the Haar's school down in Devon, plus ACAT and Frank Ottewell's school, and you know, quite a lot of them. So I had a chance to see lots of different ways of working, and I would say probably the biggest thing that struck me once I'd done that was that on the one hand, the differences weren't that great. That is, you had a lot of very talented and very dedicated teachers who were very different. In other words, I was able to get past that barrier that says my way is the good way and all those other people, there's something wrong with them. Because if I could see some of the brilliance and good teaching of the other, whichever approach it was. But on the other hand, what I could also see was all these differences, and of course you automatically have an outside point of view when you come into a different style. You get to see things with kind of new eyes, and you get to see the good stuff they have, but you also get to see the stuff that doesn't work, that sometimes they don't even know doesn't work. And of course you get a perspective, I got a perspective after a while on the way that I trained and began to see some of the areas that were limiting in the way that I was trained. So it was kind of eye-opening in that sense. I have to say, personally, my experience from all these different ways was quite open and welcoming for the most part, at least before I got into any politics. The people were quite open, but I could also see that there was a lot of prejudice, if you like.
So how friendly were the various schools and the various styles, or did people stick to, say, the Patrick McDonald crowd or the Walter crowd or the Barlow crowd?
Well, I think in those days, and we're talking the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, they were fairly insular, and there was a lot of tendency of negative innuendo, let's say, between the various schools. But on the other hand, because it was really starting to boom, you know, a lot of the schools had almost closed during the 60s. It was a very dry period, but things blew open. There was a lot of interest in alternative things, and so the Alexander technique took off in the 70s and 80s in terms of the interest and the number of people wanting to train. So a lot of the students who came in to train had been around and worked with different teachers, and they wanted to meet each other and get together a bit, even if their heads of training didn't always share the same point of view. So there were some somewhat clandestine meetings, and others not quite so clandestine. But there was not, and probably in some ways still is not, a huge amount of mixing, which I think is rather unfortunate. I mean, I think probably the biggest unfortunate thing with this work is there's never really been an attempt to say, let's all get together and look at how we see the work and how what we think it's all about, and really look at what works and what doesn't and refine it. Get rid of the stuff that doesn't work, no matter who did it and where it came from, and look at the stuff that really does work. You know, this goes back to the thing I was saying before. I was very, very shocked at one point when I really realized that some people were not really interested in the truth. Like, how does it work? They just wanted to do their style and said, well, people will like my style or they won't, so what? And there can be other styles, I'll be tolerant. You know, they can do it their way, but we're not really interested in looking at, is this the way people actually function? Is this true or not?
Did you ever feel like you joined a cult, a form of mind control?
No. It's definitely not mind control, although I think there are certain pedagogical differences in the teaching that can tend to make it rather indoctrinating, put it that way. That is, the main pedagogy is the students are learning how the master thinks rather than learning how to think for themselves. But that's, again, that may or may not be changing in some areas. I think in general, you know, when you look back in the history of things, there wasn't a lot of emphasis put on the pedagogy. The emphasis was on the premises, and you just taught it. You know, who cares how you did it? You just taught it. And some people may have been good teachers and some not, but they weren't really looking at how they were teaching. And does that particular format work well? Does this particular format work well? If you tell people things, do they learn better than if you get them exploring and discovering things? But it was a very big eye-opener for me when I ran into some teachers, not Alexander teachers, but other people, particularly Bob Abramson, who was a fantastic Dal Crozier Eurythmics teacher and composition music teacher at Juilliard and Manhattan School of Music. And I met him when I lived in New York, and he just changed my whole thinking around teaching and how to teach and what makes sense to do, and that was part of what changed my work, actually, I'd say, to get people exploring more and discovering that if you set them loose to explore — this is a training course I'm talking about now, not necessarily private students, but the same thing applies in a different sort of format — but when you get them exploring, they tend to find all the same stuff that we would be trying to teach them as teachers, but they're discovering it, and therefore they know it better than when they're just trying to imitate us. That they've actually realized, hey, I can look around me, I can find these things, and it's part of my perception of what goes on, rather than I do it this way because my teachers did it this way, because that's the way you do it and that's right, and I daren't do anything else because that might be wrong. But I don't even know on its own merits whether something's right or wrong. It's just orthodox or it isn't.
Do you have any thoughts on how the personal foibles of F.M. Alexander have affected the Alexander world?
Well, see, I didn't know Alexander, so it's a little harder to connect the person you see in front of you. It's a little easier to connect the person you see in front of you with the work and what comes out of it when you actually have experienced the person. So I have some ideas from people that I've talked to and spent time with who did know him, Buzz Gummery and various people who trained with him in that first group. But I have a clearer sense of how the work was affected by the personalities, which includes the good side and the foibles, of the teachers who were teaching it, you know, who I actually saw, who I knew personally and saw in action. And then you can see very clearly that the teachers, and then that generation in particular, those teachers' personalities became the style. You know, that McDonald style is Mr. McDonald. That Carrington style is all about Carrington, at least in from that period when he was the dominant force on the training course. That changed at a certain point. But.
Well, let me just bounce a couple of things off you. It strikes me that insecurity is one of the dominant traits of F.M. Alexander the man, and that this has been inherited by the profession. Do you have any thoughts on that, or I could elaborate if you wish?
Well, I would certainly not have put the word insecure on Alexander himself, so perhaps you want to fill me in on where you're...
Okay, so for instance, he was tremendously reluctant for any kind of scientific evaluation of his claims. So on the one hand, when you read his books, he's so eager, like almost pathetically eager for doctors and scientists to endorse what he's doing. But on the other hand, he was not secure enough to ever submit his work for a scientific investigation or to organize any kind of scientific investigation of his claims. And this has been carried on by almost all the major teachers of the Alexander technique. They have not been eager for an outside scientific, and I'm simply using scientific in the sense of following truth wherever it leads, investigation of the claims of the technique.
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with you at all about that second part. I think there's a huge number of teachers now who are eager for any kind of scientific validation that they can find, and it is actually starting to happen in various ways. As far as Alexander, again, you see, I'm at a disadvantage here. I didn't know him or talk to him about that, so I only have secondhand information. Largely through the training where I spent more of my time and these kind of questions came up. I didn't know McDonald or Barlow personally enough to ever ask questions like that. But I remember Walter just basically saying he wasn't anti-scientific. In fact, he was quite happy to have the support of people. He just didn't want the work to be put to the kind of mechanistic science of that day that he thought it would probably mean if people did it. I think it's probably a very different sort of science, you know, as witnessed the kind of studies that have been done recently for the surgeons or from that British medical journal study. Those are very different sorts of medical studies than I think would ever have been done back in the early part of the 1900s. So on the other hand, see, but my main sense of it from first-hand stuff is that Alexander was the very opposite of insecure. He was, as Buzz Gumry put it once, had the most elephantine ego of anybody he'd ever met. And he had a absolute certainty about the work and the value of it. He was pretty choosy about where he would bring that out, or I guess presumably who he would interface with it. But again, I'm kind of reluctant to go into things about people that I don't know personally, because a great deal of it we fill in from a distance without any first-hand knowledge, you know.
So do you see F.M. Alexander, the man, playing a similar role in the teaching of Alexander technique today as, say, Pilates does in Pilates work, or Moshe Feldenkrais in Feldenkrais work? Or is there something unique in a kind of a cult of personality that we have going on in Alexander technique?
No, my experience in every work that I've seen a bit from the inside, I haven't done any other works, but I've done a lot of teaching it in training groups, Feldenkrais trainings, chiropractic trainings, osteopathy trainings, and so on. And I see it happening everywhere. There are those who think that the founder was perfect and everything the founder said is true and must be kept up, and they're threatened by anything outside it. And equally, there are those who get past that to begin to see ways they can evolve the work and change it. And on the opposite extreme, there are those who want to drag in anything and take it anywhere without really any regard for how and whether it fits in with the principles of the work they started from. So I don't really see the Alexander technique as being any different in terms of the people and the professional side of it. I think there are some very big differences, at least depending on how you interpret the work. How you see the work, there are some very big differences in the Alexander technique as an approach, as a way of seeing ourselves, as an understanding of ourselves, than in almost any of the other kind of works in a somewhat similar territory. Often get lumped under body work or, you know, helping people change or whatever you want to call it. But again, I think that depends very much on how you interpret the Alexander technique. There are some strands of the work out there, quite a lot in fact, that I would think are really not much different from a sort of bodywork, hands-on bodywork, that are attempting to bring about a different state in people, compared to the other approach, which is the one I'm more squarely in, is the recognition that we really have this innate, wonderful coordinating system, and we need to find out how we can get out of the way and allow it to work for us. Which means we're taking things away from what we're doing. We're not learning. We're not trying to change a bad experience into a good one. We're asking ourselves, now, why on earth would I be having this bad experience in the first place?
There seems to be a much bigger role for diagnosis in learning methods than in traditional Alexander technique. Is that accurate?
Well, yes, to some degree. I mean, the framework is often different. I think the thing that can tend to limit, and of course, you know, as soon as we start to speak about the Alexander technique, are we speaking about a thing? Are we speaking about what Alexander did? Are we speaking about a thing of which there is an actual definition, or are we simply speaking about that part of it that we know about, and there may be other people who think of it so differently? It's you know, it's kind of helpful at least to know which one we're talking about at different times. But I would say there's one of the big changes that happened for me was when I saw that premise that Alexander had, that first chapter of his book where he talks about having really recognized that he was finding these things he was doing that he was doing unconsciously and he didn't know. And and so he then had to make them conscious and inhibit them and direct and da-da-da-da. And I think that basic premise still sits under a vast proportion of the Alexander work, is that the teacher is the one who has the knowledge and the information, who can look at the pupil, put their hands on the pupil, and, if you like, diagnose these misuses that often the pupil isn't even aware of, and then help them get aware of them either by showing them or by facilitating a change that throws that prior state into contrast. In other words, that we have these unconscious habit patterns we need to become aware of. But I think that just isn't true. I mean, that really is missing a huge part, is that no one is going around tensing themselves or pulling their head back. Though it is very clear when you look at some people in some movements, they are tense and their heads are pulling back, but they are not doing it. And that was one of the big insights for me when I really recognized I'd been kind of assuming there was this kind of black box of habit, that people were doing these things and it was my job to bring that to awareness and help them not do it, inhibit it, and as opposed to really recognize, okay, so here's a physical coordination happening which is not very good. There's a lot of tension, there's a lot of strain, they just want to stand up and their legs tightened, their back arched, their head pulled back. There's a lot of forces in that are not good, but they weren't doing it. The question for me originally was, they're not doing that. They don't even know it's happening. I would have to point it out and show them in the mirror. So this really came out of, crystallized for me on one particular lesson when I had somebody in I asked them to stand up, and I said to him at the end, I said, well, did you realize you pulled your head back when you stood up? And he said, no, I didn't. Very good. And I said, well, I can show you in the mirror. And he said, well, I'm sure you can show me in the mirror. I mean, I'm sure I did it, but I'm sure it happened, but I didn't do it. And it just really, really struck me. All of a sudden it came together, and I thought, well, he's absolutely right. He didn't do it, but it happened. He wasn't questioning in the slightest whether it happened, but he was quite adamant he didn't do it. And that's when I realized, now I would normally get very busy here convincing him he did do it, but unconsciously. And it's those kind of habits that are giving him the problem, and he's now responsible for finding them with my help and coming out of those. But instead I suddenly recognize, geez, he's right, he didn't do it. But if it happened and he didn't do it, what was he doing when it happened? Because maybe that's relevant. and I actually realized I hadn't got a clue what people were up to when these so-called misuses were happening. But I determined to find out. I said to myself, I'm going to find that out. I'm going to stop people in the middle of working every time I see one of those misuses, and rather than point it out to them or show them or try to facilitate a difference, I'm going to find out, where are you and what are you up to right now? What are you thinking? Where's your attention? What are you... And it was rather confusing for a lot of people, and, you know, stopping somebody in the middle of movement. But eventually I saw it quite clearly, is that in the simple act of standing, for instance, what it was most people were just way out ahead of themselves. They weren't pulling their head back. They were nowhere near their body. They were already way out, halfway up to standing, even before they left the chair. That's what they were doing. They were end gaining for standing. They were, or when they're sitting, from standing, they weren't pulling their head back sitting down. Their attention was way out behind their bum at the chair already. So they'd narrowed and pulled out ahead of themselves, and their whole physical system had simply kind of followed in this reaching out kind of mode. And the more I looked at that, the more it made sense that they, in effect, what I was seeing there were balance reactions. Somebody was trying to get off the chair before they were over their feet. Or someone was sitting down by going off support before they touched the chair, and their arms reached out and their head pulled back as they, in effect, reached for balance. And once I saw that and saw, in effect, what the person was doing and why they got organized that way, and was able to get people to not try to stop pulling their head back when they weren't doing it, but instead just see that they could stay in support on the chair as they came forward until they were over their feet, and they would come up to standing and there was no head pulling back and no tightening, and they didn't have to inhibit a single thing other than not go out ahead of themselves. In other words, when they saw what they were really doing, they could change that and just, in a sense, stay present with where they were at each moment. And then the coordination came out wonderfully. And they weren't at all getting directly involved in the coordination. Now, this one really woke me up, because I suddenly had a whole new interpretation of the use of the self. But prior to that, I'd been thinking, okay, when you stand up and you pull your head back, that's a misuse. Oh, look at that person. Look at the misuse on them. But what we're talking about is we're talking about somebody's physical functioning, heads pulling back, shoulders raised, tightening. But we're not talking about the self at all, the person. But as soon as we look at it this way and we go, now what's the person up to? Here's a person who's rushing, trying to get his work done, trying to get more done than he can get done during the day, and he's getting tenser and tenser and more stressed. Then the functioning is the tension and stress. That's how your coordinating system coordinates you trying to do more than you can do. But the misuse is that the person doesn't realize that you can't do more than you can do in the time available, and if you try to do it because you think you should, you'll simply end up with a coordination of rushing, which is tension and stress. So it really differentiated the use of the self by finding out, well, what is the person up to here?
So, yeah, go ahead.
Well, just say the last part of this, in a sense, is that it completely changed the teaching role. No longer was I the expert who could look at the person or put my hands on and feel where they had these misuses that I was going to have to get them aware of. In other words, I'm the leader. I'm the one with the knowledge. And they're the ones that are going to be learning the way I see it, to see themselves the way I see them, learning all this new jargon and new things to do. Suddenly it turned around and they're the expert, because I have no idea where they are and what they're up to and what they're thinking. I can see the misuses. I know there's probably something unconstructive going on, but I don't know what it is, because they're the only person who knows, where am I, what am I up to, what am I thinking, what am I feeling, how am I reacting? And so it became more of a process of helping them explore their own experience and make sense out of it. So here you've got these symptoms, and here you are, you're at work, it became even less about what goes on in the teaching room and more what goes on out there in the world. Here you are at work, you're starting to feel yourself tense. Instead of trying to get rid of the tension, if you could stop and ask yourself, now what have I been up to that this is the coordination of? Oh yeah, okay, if I look and I can see I've just been rushing here, typing away, trying to get all this stuff done. And if I correlate that and then see, well, perhaps that's this whole, what I feel right now is the wake-up call to alert me to what I've been doing. If I slow down and just take the time it takes to do what I do, will my whole functioning change? And of course it does. The person eases up, frees up, comes more into the present, but they haven't had to change their physical system one little bit. They haven't had to release their shoulders or free their neck or do anything. They simply changed what they were up to that was causing that poor coordination, if you like, but it's a perfect coordination of what they were up to. And so they're learning more about, okay, when I do this, when my use of myself, the way I go about things is like this, this is what it feels like to be doing that. And they get literally to be able to use their system as a guide to alert them to look closely at how they're meeting their life and what they're doing. And so they learn how they function. And I don't mean physically function, I mean how they go about and meet the moments of their life and are able to register the value of that by the state that they're in.
So you found some thought constructs that really interfere with a person's optimal functioning. You found the thought construct you were just talking about of rushing around, you know, I've got a rush. And this produced impaired functioning. And then with performers, you notice that the thought construct of, I've got to play well or I've got to perform well, that significantly impaired their functioning. Are there other major thought constructs that you've deduced that interfere with optimal functioning?
Yes, well, I'd say there's probably two big, maybe three big areas. One is often more outside the normal reason people might come for the Alexander technique, except for the functioning results they get. I tend to call those the reactive habits. You know, I'm impatient, I'm trying to do too much, I don't think I'm good enough, I'm trying to be perfect, and all the ways we kind of meet our life in a more emotional, psychological way of not just being present as who we are and going ahead, we're after something, we're into the present, we're reacting to the past, we're judging, we're, you know, all those kind of things that have a strong, obviously, physical component, generally very negative. The other major character territory is the one that's perhaps more normally dealt with in the Alexander work, is that a lot of people just have very, very misconceived sense of what it means to function in space and support. So here they are in support on the planet, but they're not in support. They're consistently way off to the front of their feet or the back, or they're consistently distorting their structure in one way or another, you know, hauling this up, holding this, trying to be like this. And every movement they make, they move, you know, somebody's standing there to pick something up, they reach out of support and force lots of holdings and tightenings and balance reactions. And they simply don't realize what they're doing. They've never learned how to operate freely in space. So there's that territory. There's the reactive territory. And then there's the third one, which often comes out of the other two, which is people that have started to directly try to run their system. They're not just reacting to what goes on in their life, they're not just using themselves poorly in space because they never learned how it works. They've got various problems from those first two, one or other of them or both of them, and they're now in there actually trying to release this and fix this up and direct this and you know, do these various methods, so they're directly in there interfering by trying to take over and with all the best intentions. And that just makes things more and more complicated.
Now, you've taught Alexander around the world. Do you have any thoughts on the different roles that Alexander technique plays in different countries? For instance, it seems much more known in Britain, for instance, than in the United States. So could you talk about what you've learned?
I think that's just historical, in that Alexander came there and trained there and trained people there, and they tend to stay there and develop the work. You know, it always starts from where it starts. I mean, for instance, give you a little example. There was a training course down in Devon in a small town called Totnes for quite a number of years. Very small town, like 3,000 people. And they must have turned out, it was a relatively big training course. They had at least 10, 15, you know, people or more. And a lot of people that came down there, of course, didn't come from that town. They came from somewhere else. But they stayed there for 3 years. They liked it there. They got relationships. And so they probably had more Alexander teachers per capita than anywhere else in the world, simply because there was a training course there, not because there was even a lot of work for them. So I think that's the major thing, is it develops out of centers wherever it starts, and eventually somebody goes off and starts to teach in another city and they're the only person there. They spread, they get people interested, maybe somebody trains somewhere else and comes back there, and then maybe they eventually start a training, and it gradually grows. But I don't think it has anything to do with the country or the culture. It's just one of those organic things. It's the same token that says why largely, let's say in America, the early trainings out of ACAT in particular, which was the first training, homegrown training there, had a lot of performers and a lot of dance people, simply because the people that started it were dancers, and they attracted other dancers. So much of the performer base in England tended to be more musicians, simply because some musicians are getting into it, they tell other musicians, and those musicians come there. Basically the same reason why there were so many Israelis at McDonald's, simply because a few of them came and they told others and they went there rather than go somewhere else.
Yeah, I've often been curious why Patrick McDonald style swept Israel and why there are more Alexander teachers per capita in Israel than anywhere else.
Well, and I suspect, of course, there's probably a certain sympathy of personality styles there, too, in a certain way, but I think it's also just where it starts from. I mean, I saw this when I started my training in London, running my own training, and I had a couple of people come to that training who had been working as musicians with my main assistant. That's why they came to my school. They were from Scandinavia, and then I just got more and more Scandinavians until, you know, more than half the school was Scandinavians, just because they all knew each other.
So I think when you were training with Walter, and in the first year or two after graduation, there was this huge internecine conflict in STAT over teaching Alexander via group classes. Do you remember that warfare?
Well, I don't remember it so much in the years after, but I'll tell you, when I first got there, this was probably in my second year.
1980.
No, my second year of training, so it was late 78 or early 79. It was just after Don Burton and Karen Wentworth and I and a number of other people had started to do some workshops. Ken Thompson, who was a yoga teacher before he came to train with Alexander, he's one of the people that started trainings after, too. We were doing residential workshops and weekend workshops and week-long workshops out in the country, and amongst other things, offering, you know, yoga. People who wanted to do yoga before the workshop started, a la Alexander and so on, you know, things that made sense. People were going to apply this to these things anyway. And I found them absolutely fascinating. It was such a great way to work. You get people away from their normal life, and they, they're exposed to this work day after day after day. But anyway, what happened after we'd done maybe five or six of these things is suddenly Wilfred Barlow called a special general meeting of STAT to want to bounce these teachers out because they were, I can't remember the exact terms, but basically because they were doing these group classes and teaching other things than Alexander. But interestingly, of course, he'd never bothered to call any of the teachers doing it to find out what we actually did or how we actually did it. But so here was this huge special general meeting to censure all these various teachers, called, held at his place in their big basement flat near Royal Albert Hall. And all these speeches by various people, including Barlow and John Gray, and lots of innuendo about what was going on. And, you know, that was when it finally came out what actually happened. And I remember at one point Walter stood up and said, well, you know, we all trained with Alexander and we're all doing things very differently and we all found our ways of doing it, and I think we should just let people, you know, they're all good people, we should let them find their way and make their experiments and they too will. And I was going, okay, that's my guy, I'm training with him. Anyway, the upshot was the whole thing was actually, I think, quite a big embarrassment for the people that brought it when it really came out that it wasn't, what was really happening on those workshops was not at all what they thought was happening. But they hadn't bothered to find out, talk about prejudice and jumping to conclusions. So it basically all got voted down, and that was the last anything was heard formally.
So you had every reason to be prepared for a hostile reaction to your own innovations on the work, or could you possibly be prepared for the hostile reactions that you received, you know, on the Alex Tech I think, email list when you started coming out with your developments on the technique?
Well, that was actually quite a bit after I'd come out on a lot of it. I'd already ended my training course and had moved out of the UK by the time I decided to engage with that that thing that just exploded on the list there. But no, I don't think anybody's prepared for it. I think, you know, at that particular point, I mean, this is years before when I was running the training and I was finding quite a few new things, and I was seeing it as a real advancement of the work. And I would have been very, very happy to have been a contributor in some way to the evolution of the Alexander technique. In fact, in many ways, as I was saying before, I thought I was going more to the heart of it by really recognizing, you know, when we're talking about the use of the self, this is really the self. This is what the person is up to, not what their body is up to that they don't even know about. So we're getting these words much more literal and clear. And when we're speaking about non-doing, you know, we're really meaning that. We're really meaning coming up, putting hands on it, not being after anything at all. Not trying to change yourself or direct yourself, and not trying to change or direct the other person, just completely being in the moment and allowing those responses to affect each other. So I'd have been very happy to have, you know, been able to contribute towards that. And interestingly, of course, the ones who did come and did spend time in my training or on workshops found a huge amount of value, and there wasn't a single complaint from any of them. The complaints, and this is always true, and it's exactly what happened in the special meeting of STAT I was just telling you about that Barlow called, is that the ones who didn't know, who'd heard things and jumped to conclusions, who were, in fact, what's that phrase Alexander uses there, the ignorance and prejudice. You know, they were ignorant of what was really happening, but they were prejudiced against it even though they didn't know what it was. And they were the ones who reacted. So it was all rather... It just so happened at a certain point some of them had a bit of power, so they, you know, they ended up making a lot of trouble, which is unfortunate. But
how do the British teachers regard their American counterparts?
Well, you're asking that question in the present tense, so I don't really think I can answer for British teachers at this point. When I was there, you know, from the point I trained, what are we talking, 80, 30 some years ago, up to the point I left the UK in 97 when I finished my training course, I'd say there was a shift from a general sense that they didn't know what they were doing and they weren't well trained because they didn't train in STAT, to more and more of them, of the British teachers who had been, let's say, to the congresses or had done workshops with teachers that came over. I brought quite a few of them over to work in my training. Tommy Thompson and Bruce Furtman and David Mills and a whole bunch of them, Barbara Connable, that they began to see, well, these people actually have a lot to offer too. And so that all tended to dissipate. But in the beginning, most of them thought there was no particular value. They weren't properly trained. They were all working in groups. And again, they were extremely ignorant of what was really going on. When I went and started to teach in the States, I was very pleasantly surprised as I met people having, you know, heard that attitude to go, hey, it's some really great teachers here. That was a lot of the spur for me when I was starting NASTAT, which is now AMSAT, to go, this is crazy to have all this separation. We should be getting together here and recognizing everybody who's good. The point is not to keep out the people that aren't good. The point is to get everybody who is good in.
I see differences between the American and the British approach to Alexander technique in that it seems in America, Americans are very pragmatic, you know, does it work? While in Britain, there seems to be much more of a stress on lineage, like, you know, did you train with someone who trained with F.M. Alexander? You know, how close are you to the great man himself? And so it seems to me that your learning methods comes out of that kind of pragmatic American bottom line attitude of does it work?
Well, I don't know. I think it's easy to stereotype things, but you know, when you get to know enough teachers, you can see any of those attitudes in both places for sure. So I would hesitate to put anything in like that. I think we can speak of it as a range of attitudes, but whether it's localized the way you're saying it, that doesn't really make sense to me. I think by far the bigger force that's at work here is simply the ways that people trained in the respective countries. You know, for instance, you have quite a lineage, if you like, or a style in America and Canada to some degree of people that came out of the way of working from Marjorie Barstow.
Yeah.
And to some degree from the works, the connections she had with Frank Pierce Jones and A.R. Alexander, who was a very, very different teacher than F.M. And so that's quite a different way of seeing the work than the people, I'm just speaking about American ones now, the ones that, say, came out of the ACAT lineage, which again started off kind of, as it were, on its own, out of Luly Westfelt and then, you know, coming back from the training along with Judy Leibowitz and names are sort of missing me, but and then ultimately branched out, you know, Frank Ottewell and so on. But then you also have the people from who trained in the UK who came back who are probably in many ways no different in their approach from the way that they trained, whether they would have stayed in the UK or gone to America, like Alex Murray and a bunch of them. So, you know, and those are very different styles. I think one of the bigger kind of interesting things when you go back to the personalities is seems to me a bit between, let's say, the Alexander brothers, was that Alexander had problems. You know, he had problems when he was a kid with his breathing, and he had problems with his voice, and so he tended to have a framework on solving problems. Whereas AR never had any particular problems. He seemed to have been happy and healthy and, generally speaking, pretty okay in his use and his functioning, at least until he had that fall from the horse many years later. So his emphasis in his work was not on solving problems, it was on your thinking and your, you know, the way you meet the moment differently, as witnessed by the work that came out with Marjorie Barstow and Frank Pierce Jones and the people that were, Buzz Gumry and people that worked more with AR than with FM.
Do you think the Alexander technique could ever be as popular as yoga?
Well, it's a very different sort of thing. I think that's sort of like saying, do you think horse racing could ever be as popular as soccer? You know, they're not at all in the same territory to me. It's very unlikely, I think, that you'd have a Alexander ever turning into something where you can just have a drop-in class and go in with 20 people and go through a set of postures that don't need any particular individual. Now, yoga well done. I work with a lot of yoga people. In fact, I'm working with a brilliant yoga person in Finland every year, and we're thinking of writing a book together on how you can really get at what happens in yoga and why people injure themselves and how they can go for the changes that they're really after there if they understand their systems better. But I think you're after very different sort of works there. And at this point, I don't think it really matters. You know, put it the other way around, I think if Alexander became as popular as yoga, what on earth would we do? We don't even have the teachers for it. And I don't think we even have the pedagogy very clear for it. So in a sense, I would hope not, at least until, you know, we kind of get our stuff together a little more in terms of how to make sense out of the work and teach it. But I don't actually hold out any, I'm not holding my breath that there's going to be a, you know, kind of getting together of people to sort out how the work, what is this work and how does it work and what are we actually like. And I think like any work, it will tend to diverge. You know, even now, I think it's very interesting if you look at these scientific studies that are coming up. They're all speaking of how many lessons you have in the Alexander technique. How many, and they're going as if there's a thing called the Alexander technique, but they're not actually looking at, okay, they had 6 lessons or 24 lessons with these particular Alexander teachers teaching the work in this particular way, which had these measurable benefits. That doesn't say anything about if you had 6 or 24 lessons with this other group of Alexander teachers who teach it in a very, very different way, what would have come out of that?
So how popular do you think this Alexander thing can be?
I have no idea. It's in a sense, you see, I don't think it's up to us either because, you know, we're, let me put it around, kind of coming at it from the other angle. There's no shortage of people with problems looking for solutions. And there seems to be more and more all the time. So in that sense, the market, if you want to put it that way, is huge and growing. On the other hand, there's even more other methods out there competing now than there were in the 60s and 70s and 80s when I started the work. And so it doesn't depend just on us, it depends on what else comes up that might in fact actually get more to the heart of what goes on for people in helping them. Ideally, in my opinion, we would get more back to honing down, you know, what really is going on with people, how do we get this across to people, and primarily how do we get it so that young kids learn how they function in the world, and I don't just mean physically and, you know, movement and bending, but how they meet all these things that so many people end up meeting with misunderstandings and reaction. If they could learn that in school instead of all the kings of England or the presidents of the United States or something that you can get on the internet in 2 seconds if you ever need it in the future, then, you know, we'd be in a whole different world. And I'm not even saying that's the Alexander technique. We're learning about ourselves then.
I notice with teachers and trainees that there are often these wistful discussions about essentially could Alexander technique ever become popular, and it's always struck me that the technique is an elite technique. It's only going to appeal to a tiny percentage of the population because it requires so much from the student.
Well, I think in a certain sense you're right. It's elite in two different ways. One is that because it's basically private and most people have to pay for it, as opposed to having it covered, then it's too expensive for most people. So it's elite in that sense, even if, you know, teachers do offer reductions as and when they can. But I think a lot of that is also the pedagogy too, because a huge amount, you know, as I've understood more and more clearly, you know, where do the problems come from, a lot of them are not very hard to change. And let's contrast two different ways of approaching it. For instance, if we're looking at somebody who has a, you know, physical problem of back, let's say back problem, lower back or hip problem or something, you're coming for lessons, and let's say the average kind of lesson is the teacher putting hands on and guiding somebody through movement, but the student doesn't have any idea really, you know, why they're having the problem in the first place, and they're having a different experience at the hands of the teacher, but they don't really know how they got there, and they're ending up at best having to do this kind of thinking about and directing and freeing in themselves, and, you know, that is going to take anybody lesson after lesson after lesson for months and possibly years, and even then a lot of people say they still don't quite get it, they still can't do it on their own, so they come for lessons for years. If you contrast that with helping somebody really understand, you know, why they're having that pain because of the way they're moving, and to, let's say, even just as simply as show them what it means to stay in support and go about it in kind of a step-by-step kind of way that literally gets them back in touch so they can feel what they're doing. You can have them able to stand up and move and bend in one or two lessons in a way that would take 60, 70, 80% of the strain off their system, and they can already integrate that in their life. And so it's not nearly as big a thing because it's not all mystified for them by this, you know, idea that they've got these unconscious things. In effect, you're no longer trying to get them to run their body. You're helping them actually make sense out of the experiences they're having. Why is this full of effort when I stand up? Well, because you're trying to stand up before you're over your feet, or because you're reaching out ahead of yourself, and the further you reach out ahead, the more the muscles have to tighten to support you until you feel like it's a lot of strain to reach any further. So, don't reach. You know, it's a lot simpler than I think a lot of people think. So a lot of those changes, especially some of those chronic ones where people are in what they think of as a stressful job, and they don't realize that there's no such thing as a stressful job. There's an attitude they have towards that job which is stressing them. In fact, often people are in a job, in a company, and they have other people around them that aren't stressed by it at all, and they don't put two and two together and go, it can't be a stressful job if this other person isn't stressed. But they don't think to ask the other person how they see the job to figure out why they're not getting stressed by it. Because they're not used to looking at their own thinking and going, now, what am I up to and how do I see this? Instead, they just go, oh, I'm all stressed and tense. How do I get rid of that? And they will often go to any number of different body works, but Alexander too, and the upshot is they won't have changed a single thing about how they meet the job. They'll just have gotten very good at getting rid of the tension whenever they feel it. But they'll still have it. They'll still have to work over and over again all day long to get rid of it, because it'll still keep coming back, because they're still viewing the job in the same way, or the relationship, or the performance, or the... So they haven't really changed, they've just got a coping mechanism.
How do you present this work to doctors, and how do they react?
I haven't done a lot with doctors. I just found myself over the course of the years generally having the work come to me, so I've never really had to go out and get it. And I recognize that's not always typical, but, and so partly because of the people I attracted or the circles I first started to travel in, I ended up working much more with performers than with, you know, medical conditions or even athletes or something. That's just my particular history. So that's where but when I have run into doctors, again, for the most part, it's not doctor as a function, therefore I'm having to persuade the doctor something about their students. It's doctor who has a problem, who's come to me to work out, you know, what's going on in their own life. So by the time they've gone through that and had the changes and understood that, then they're already sold because they've experienced it.
Where do you see the Alexander work fitting in with the health profession? And do you have any thoughts on how Alexander technique teachers should be presenting themselves to health professionals such as doctors?
Well, again, Luke, that's kind of a hard one to answer, because you'd have to ask which sort of Alexander teachers are we talking about here? You know, are we talking about ones who do a thing they call the Alexander technique, and when they go to present to doctors, their goal is to have the doctor think the Alexander technique that they do is pretty good and they're going to refer people to them? Is that the goal? In which case, you know, they're marketing. That's a different thing than, let's say, someone who's saying, hey, you know, here's a lot of problems people have, problems that they bring to doctors, problems that they bring to me. I think I have a certain handle on why these problems are happening, and I know that doctors just don't even see that side of it. You know, somebody with the back pain goes into the doctor, slumps down in the chair and says, Doc, I got this bad back, and the doctor goes, well, we'll have to order some x-rays and see what's going on, instead of going, I'm not surprised, look at the way you're sitting, look at the way you probably move. But, you know, most doctors have no concept whatsoever of anything, you know, about how someone uses themselves and how that can lead to problems. So, for that matter, or physiotherapists, and consequently, if one was going and saying, okay, I see the kind of people you're dealing with, how can we, you know, are you interested in looking a bit at what goes on here and seeing if there's a better way for you to do that? You know, that's what I often end up doing. I'll just give you an example. I was invited to come and teach for a couple of weeks to a group of doctors and physiotherapists from rehabilitative clinics at hospitals and so on in Taiwan three or four years ago. And they were all doctors and all physiotherapists who worked in, mostly in hospitals, some in private, or, you know, in outpatient clinics. And as we got as I was going through material, I began to realize that, you know, that they actually were unaware of this whole relatively recent, it's not like it's the last couple of years, but last 10 or 15 years of knowledge about how the muscles can change their subtype from the red slow twitch, from the white fast twitch fatiguing fibers to the red slow twitch kind of non-fatiguing fibers, which has huge relevance for us in our Alexander work, but also for anybody who's helping people with anything to do with posture and rehabilitation. And so they're mostly dealing with people that have been injured and are in hospitals and then are getting back up on their feet and have lost a lot of muscle mass. But what they were doing, of course, with all their exercises that they give people is training them in exactly the ways that will build the wrong kind of muscle. They'll get stronger, they'll get bigger muscles, but they'll get the more of the white fast twitch muscles, which can stand you up and hold you up but fatigue very quickly, and all you want to do is slump or collapse, or, you know, the basic place that most people find themselves in. And because they didn't even really know much about the two different kinds of muscle and the conditions that caused the change between one and the other, then, you know, I had a chance to not only help them understand how it works, but how they could change their their remedial activities to take advantage of it. Basically, I don't know if you want to get into the details here, I can make it very brief, but the red slow twitch fibers are primarily developed. The white fast twitch fibers are the default fibers. It's how your system will be unless you use yourself to meet several conditions, and only as long as you meet those conditions, then the muscles will tend to become more predominantly the red slow twitch non-fatiguing fibers. And the two conditions, interestingly, are that the muscles need to be active while they're under stretch. So if you think of, say, what we go through when we train as Alexander teachers and we spend that time, you know, beginning to bend in monkey and leave ourselves nicely open and expanded and free, so we're not going into a bend and then tightening up. We're not holding a posture with a lot of tightening, which most people do. So when they do that, they have the muscles working, but the muscles aren't operating under stretch, they're operating in contraction. But when you release and open up and you're then in that more free, expanded, you know, Alexander jargon, going up kind of state, your muscles are active for sure, but they're active in the sense that they're under stretch and responding to that stretch by toning up to match it. Now, this may or may not make sense, this part of it, but it's a very different functioning, as I'm sure, you know, anybody that's had that experience knows how different it feels. And it's those are precisely the conditions that change the musculature, so that when you go to training, for instance, and you find no matter how good a monkey bend you get into, it may feel free for a moment, but your knees are still going to smoke after a couple minutes because you still have the old white fast twitch fibers that will fatigue very easily there no matter how good your use is. But I don't know if you had this experience. I sure
yes.
did.
Yes.
After about 6 months of training, or you know, some period of training where you do this a lot, one day you just kind of realize, hey, I've been bending over this table working on somebody for 20 minutes now and I don't feel anything. And it's not because you got your use better, although I'm sure that happened too. It's because the muscles had time to become different muscles that can now operate without fatigue. And you know, I met up last year in London with Jeffrey Goldspink, who was the person who discovered all of this, working at University College Hospital in London. And because I wanted to check out my theories on all this before I published it, and I went through that with him, and he basically agreed that's really what's happening. Is we're basically what we're talking about is the evolutionary shift from creatures coming out of the water where they didn't need to have any support. So they had, that's why the white fast twitch fibers are the default fibers, because in the water you don't need support, you just need fast, powerful movement, but generally only for a short period. When we came out on land, we suddenly had to support ourselves in an ongoing way, and that's when the evolutionary change, genetic change came in that allowed the fibers to switch. And so the postural muscles, the ones that are being pulled into stretch by the instability in the parts, beautifully enough, can just, when you open yourself up to gravity and let that into you, those muscles are operating that way, and they will change into, given a bit of time, they will change into exactly the kind of muscles that let you maintain that open and free use without any fatigue whatsoever.
And how did the Taiwanese doctors react to what you presented?
Well, they loved it. It opened up a lot of possibilities for them. So I kept in touch with some of them for a while afterwards, and a couple of things happened. Some of them were actually able to integrate a lot of this into their practice, but they were also running into the same thing many medical people do, is they're up against a huge time pressure. They see people maybe 15 minutes. They have this expensive equipment there that are, and all the people working in it, so the people that are rehabilitated, they're coming in to spend time in the clinic, very short time with the doctors, and then go and work on these machines, supervised, but working with a lot of them. You know, each person who's supervising is working with a lot of people. So their recognition was that this would probably be a very good thing to bring in, but we'd have to change everything around in the the bureaucracy and the institution isn't, it just isn't set up for. And so it didn't go very far, but some of them said, yeah, we're finding ways to use it. In fact, interesting enough, most of them found a lot more ways to use it personally, in terms of their own activities and their own understanding. But you know, this is one of the reasons I think if we truly look at what we're doing, what the implications of what we're doing are, and then go, do we just want to go to a doctor so that we'll get more referrals? Or do we want to go and actually have the way that people who have the problems get dealt with, then you run smack up against, of course, the huge momentum of the machine that you're interacting with. That is, so that's another story we can leave for someone else another day.
Okay, I got a question. Do you have any thoughts on the relationship between debauched kinesthesia and a debauched life? For instance, I've had students who lead a party life, you know, coke and hookers, and I've noticed changes in their life as they make changes in their debauched kinesthesia. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I suspect that's as much the changes they have in their whole relationship with themselves and the moment that they're in terms of, you know, being reactive or not. I think the term that Alexander came to after a while from his more Victorian debauched kinesthesia, the unreliable sensory appreciation, is probably much, much better, and even is probably better is inaccurate sensory appreciation. And you know, he says very clearly somewhere, I wish I could find the quote, I'm sure it's around, is something more or less to the effect that until you have reliable sensory appreciation, you haven't got a hope of having good use. He didn't say it in those words, but and I think it's actually very, very true that the fact that so many people are simply misinterpreting their experiences. And by the time they can have those same experiences but interpret them accurately, then they can use them for a guide. But the goal, of course, is not, like so many Alexander people understand, is there's nothing unreliable about the senses at all. Senses are telling you all kinds of stuff. You're misinterpreting it. And what it's telling you is incredibly important, so the last thing on earth you'd want to do is ignore it. What you want to do is to be able to interpret it accurately so that you can actually use it.
Well, it's hard for me to believe that someone who is, into illegal drugs and other, you know, excesses, is happy, is fundamentally moving in a smooth and coordinated way. It seems to me that there is a profound connection between a person's use of themselves and the type of life that they live.
Well, there might be for a lot of people, especially if what they're doing is to an extreme that's actually, you know, giving them negative consequences. But I think, again, we have two ways of always meeting the moment with it in, as a teacher. One is, you know, here's what I see and what I think you should do, even if you don't see it. And the other one is, well, you're the one living your life. You're out there living your life. What have you noticed that's come up for you that you don't like? You know, what wake-up calls have happened for you that we could use and explore and begin to make sense out of, so it's coming from you out of your own experience? Because then whatever we get to is always embedded in the person's own experience. It's come up out of their own experience. It's what their system delivered to them to wake up. They may not have known what to do with it in the beginning, but it's come to them. And the whole process is one of them getting more in touch and more able to make appropriate decisions and choices. The other one is a tendency where it's our judgment that tends to hold the sway, even if they don't see it that way. We're taking them out of their own experience and saying, ignore that, don't pay attention to that, here, do this, and now here's a new experience. What are you going to do with that? And the person, of course, wants to jump on it and get it and do it. But they've in the process, they've been taken out of their own experience and inevitably, and to the extent I think that the experiences we can give them, the way the ones we can facilitate, are so nice that people get very seduced by them. They want more of that. It's like a high. But they don't know where it came from, and until they think that's a goal to get to. Instead of, I go back to that thing I said earlier, instead of realizing, well, if I'm having some negative experiences from whatever I'm doing in my life, whether it's my conflicts in relationship or my drugs that I'm doing or my, you know, whatever, it doesn't really matter what it is, but if I'm having some negative consequences, then the job at hand is not how can I make that nice. The job at hand is, can I understand why that's happening? What is it that I'm up to? How am I seeing things or going about things that's giving me this crap so that I could change that?
How effectively are you able to transmit what you do to raise up other teachers in the same style?
Well, I think it's been pretty effective so far. I haven't trained all that many. I've got about 10 teachers out there now. I'm working with another 5 at this moment. But by nature with this, I suppose this should be true of every work, but it isn't always, because sometimes people are learning a sort of a skill to do rather than applying it to themselves. But certainly by nature with the learning methods stuff is you have to learn to use it on your own issues in order to even understand how it works, let alone to help anybody else. So by the time people have brought up, let's say, and worked through the major issues in their life, whether they're physical ones or emotional ones, or, you know, whatever it is that's coming up as negative ongoing issues for them, they will A, have seen that the work really works, and B, have a pretty good sense of the process being used. The remaining part is, of course, to help them see what it really means to help somebody else do that, you know, the teaching part of it.
So what are you working on these days?
Well, aside from the you know, that kind of training stuff, I've a couple of the books that I already have out are due for new editions, so I'm just putting together that small paperback, Looking at Ourselves, with a couple of new articles in it. That'll go out soon. I'm working on another book that I think I might actually have time to finish now after decades, on our kind of human structure and function from the point of view of the whole living person, the you know, what goes on in our system when everything's working well and we have wholeness and presentness and supportiveness and integration and what I'm calling these days the anatomy of wholeness. And I have a couple of other things that I'll probably publish as books, but I may put out, that I've been doing in workshops long enough to really kind of hone them. Is one is the whole territory of performance anxiety and judgment and self-doubt. As I've worked with a lot of people, I've seen very clearly the whole interlocking set of misconceptions that drives that one, and actually how easy it is to change and get out of once you see through it. The other kind of big territory I'm working with a lot of people, including a number of Alexander teachers now in one of my online groups, is this sort of graduated demonstration series about balance and support, that by the time they take somebody through, you know, actually being able to sense what's happening, and that their use just changes hugely, simply because they've finally understood. And I don't mean intellectual, I mean, you know, in an embodied, actual feeling way, what it means to operate in support and freedom in standing, walking, bending, sitting. So that, I've been doing that in workshops. I have a couple of videos and audios, but I think I'll probably either write that up as a book or do a more of a purpose-made video production, I think, for that. Might be the best way. But what I've been doing recently, I got off the road. I was traveling for decades and decades all over the place, and I just decided I had enough of that. And there were lots of people that wanted to work with me, but they were scattered all over the place. So the technology has finally reached the level where we can do a huge amount of this stuff online. So I've been playing around with the online groups where we meet every week with the live video conference call where we can all see each other and we can go through. And it's actually surprisingly effective. I have a number of groups going, one of which is my training group, another is a group of Alexander teachers, and so I'll probably keep doing that for a while too.
So how effective is teaching learning methods by phone or video?
For the most part, it's very effective. It's by nature of the approach much easier to do that way than the usual Alexander work, where you tend to need somebody there physically and your hands on them. Because basically what we're doing in learning methods is I'm helping somebody explore their own experience, use their own intelligence and apply it to their own experiences and make sense out of them. So that's largely a verbal thing, because we're not really talking most of the time about what's happening right now. We're talking about what's happening at the moments when the problems happen. And sometimes we're talking about actual activities of the moment, let's say with a performance error. But then we can easily do that over the phone too, or with the video.
Could you share a story of some breakthrough that's come about over the phone or via video?
Well, they're not much different for the most part than what happens in an in-person workshop, because we're really doing the same thing. Somebody brings up an issue and we start to explore, you know, what could be going on there. How do you find out what happened? Usually you're looking around the moment of the symptom to see what might have been going on. I'm not sure if I can think right at the moment of a specific one. I'll tell you actually an interesting sort of category of them. This that kind of floored me a little bit, because I never even considered the possibility of this, but I had a number of people who had some chronic pain come up. There was one in particular where it really coalesced, and it was the second or third one that had happened, but I began to really realize how common this was. This woman had a car accident, and she had a lot of pain in her neck, so me and my neck. And she'd been to chiropractors, she'd been to everybody, and this was like 18 months later. And I'm kind of going, I mean, it should have been healed by now, so why wouldn't it be healed? And we're normally in learning methods, we're looking for, why do you have this problem? So we're looking at all the different things that might have been happening to keep it happening. Obviously, it came from the car accident, but why it was still there that long later. And all we could kind of see that was going on that might be in any way related was that she was having a lot of treatments for it. She'd been to some chiropractor that had developed this device to stretch her head to try and reduce the curve of her neck, and she gave that up because it was excruciatingly painful. But she was getting lots of treatments of various sorts, and she was constantly kind of monitoring her neck and doing little fiddling stuff to try and get it comfortable. And we just went, all we could do out of the end of it was kind of go, well, I don't know, but do you think it's maybe possible that it's still a problem because you have gotten into a place of me and my neck, and you're constantly narrowing to your neck and fiddling with your neck, and your neck is irritated, and here you are moving it all around, all with the best of intentions, of course, but nonetheless, could it be possible that all this attention, you separated yourself and then you're fiddling with a part that's already irritated, could that be keeping it happening? Well, who knows, but there's one way to find out. If you make an experiment over the next week or two and as much as you can, choose not to go in and feel your neck. If you notice your neck hurting, just note that it's hurting, but don't go in, don't do anything to fix it up, don't fiddle with it, don't go and have any treatments, just allow yourself. It's really based on this question, you know, which would you rather have as an outcome here? You've got a bad neck, would you like to have a good neck? Or would you like to get to a place where you don't even have a separate thing called a neck anymore? And of course you say, well, I'd rather get back to just being me and not even have a neck. And I say, well, notice what you're doing though is you're going about the process of trying to fix your neck and get a good neck. After you get a good neck, then you'll just be you. But notice in the meantime, what you're doing is the sort of thing that nobody that had no neck problem would be doing. You know, if somebody had no neck problem, they wouldn't be paying any attention to their neck. They wouldn't even have a neck. They'd just be them. So what if you, in other words, what your experiment is to go about living your life as if you didn't have a neck. And even if you feel something, just don't react and get caught in it. Just go back to your wholeness, the way you'd be operating if you didn't have any problem. And sure enough, by the end of the workshop, I think, okay, do this for a number of weeks. Several days later, she said, and I just don't have much pain anymore, and after a few weeks it was just gone. And I've seen this over and over again where people are in themselves paying attention to me and my back, me and my shoulder problem. They're separating themselves and maintaining that separateness while they do good things, release their shoulder, try and do this for their back, direct it. They take their back off to somebody for treatments. And they're keeping a separation, and then they're going, I want to be whole, but I'm not being whole. I'm being in parts. And, you know, they've got the whole thing backwards. They go, I've got this body. If I get the body in shape, then I'll move in and occupy it. Instead of going, who's the boss here? You know, why don't you live the way you want and let your system organize to you? And I've seen this over and over in many cases where people that had problems, when you can't identify an actual cause, because sometimes there is very definitely a cause and they need to stop that. But some of these chronic things, they're there just because they're being paid attention to and fiddled with. And they literally disappear within a week or two when you stop that.
In what directions have you found your work developing over the past few years?
I'm not sure there's any wholly new directions. I keep on, trying to keep up with the latest new knowledge that comes out anatomically in neuroscience and everything, and find it quite fascinating. Most of the time that doesn't change my work anymore, but it validates what they're discovering, validates things that I found empirically about the way that we function, and that's kind of nice. It always helps to quote something like that for people to, you know, feel a little more confident about going into something before they've had the results of it later on. There's not very many new issues. You know, when I work with people, I've been doing this for so long now, working this way, that it's very rare that I get a new, somebody brings up something I haven't already worked with a number of times and haven't kind of got a pretty good sense of what's behind it. Though I suppose, if anything, as the time goes on, I'm getting clearer and clearer and better at working at what amount to much bigger issues for people. You know, depression and abuse and certain things like that that are really quite heavily loaded. And helping people deal with some of those. But of course all the other issues keep coming up over and over too, the chronic ones. People have injury and tension and pain on the one hand, the strain and fear and anxiety and rushing and stress. Stress is a big one.
How do you help people with depression?
Well, you see, it's really like anything else. It's they think of it as a thing. You know, I'm depressed. fact, most people tend to think of it, their symptom as the thing. I'm performing, I'm nervous, how do I get rid of the nervousness? But they don't actually ask themselves, well, nervous about what? You know, they try and get rid of the symptom instead of seeing what it's a symptom of. And it's the same thing with depression. I mean, we just take that approach and go, okay, you're feeling whatever you're feeling that you would put the label depression on. What's actually happening for you? Out there in your daily life, how are you thinking? How are you feeling? What is the whole point of view when you can, you know, my job is to get around and be beside somebody, as it were, and look out through their eyes and go, ah, so you're seeing the world that way. Uh-huh. And this is what it feels like. Depression or tension or stress or fear. Now, could it be that these are connected together? Of course, most of the time they are. When you see the way that people that have depression see the world, I don't know if you read a couple of the articles on my website there, but one of the people who I ended up training with me, but he came with an issue of depression that was basically solved in one time, one session, when we just went through how he was seeing things, and he just began to see how he was feeling very depressed about things because of how he was comparing things in his life. This world wasn't the way it should be. Here's this ideal of what it should be, and here's the way it is. And of course, the way it is seems pretty lousy when you're comparing it to the way that it isn't. And the feeling of that is for him, but it's not the same for everybody. Of course, there's many different ways of perceiving and then believing and getting caught in that could have, that somebody could put the label depression or worthlessness or, you know, whatever other shades of it that can come out. But the process is really the same. You're wanting to find out, you know, how is this person framing their life and meeting the world and seeing it, and is there a, and this is really an open-ended question. I'm not going in with the premise that there is, but the question is there a connection? If I see things this way, or I react this way, or this is how I interpret, you know, what you just said to me, does it make sense that I would have this reaction or this set of symptoms? And am I misunderstanding something? You know, right down to the kind of exploring the physical things, if I reach out of my support to pick something up, stick my arm and my torso out, and is it any surprise my legs would tighten up and I would feel by the time I've got down to the ground I'm straining hugely? The problem, of course, is that most people misinterpret that. They think it's hard to bend, they think they aren't flexible, they think they're heavy, they think it's gravity. They have an unreliable sensory appreciation. They have an unreliable interpretation of that experience. Once I can help them, you know, parse it or deconstruct it enough that they can actually see what it is they're experiencing, then of course it makes perfect sense. But the biggest thing is that they've moved from, oh, my body's wrong, I need to teach my body better, for them to see your body was working perfectly. That's what happens when you reach out of your support. And it's a damn good thing it did happen, because if it hadn't happened, you'd have crashed into the ground and broke your wrist. So your physical coordinating system is working perfectly. The problem is in the fact that you're asking it to do something that it can't do with freedom, and then you're feeling the not freedom, but you don't understand why you're feeling it, and so you don't know how to change it.
Master Alexander teachers do not have as many clients as they would wish. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I think there's many different reasons for that. Sometimes it's as simple a one as they're relatively new and they haven't been out there long enough, but they will soon enough. But I'd say that the two biggest reasons I've run into over the years is that I think they just don't understand what they're doing enough. You know, I've seen this over and over when I worked in trainings, and done workshops even with teachers that somehow they got through their training without really understanding the work. You know, they have questions. I've had heads of training even say, you know, I never quite understood that thing about direction. You're a head of training. What can you teach people if you don't understand it? And I'm not even saying you have an accurate understanding or, you know, a really good one that would stand up to scrutiny, but the fact that you don't even have one, and you know you don't have one. So, you know, sometimes it's that people are not very clear about the work. They're full of doubts about it, and they have not had an opportunity to work those through before they become teachers. Just trying to think what the other.
So you said there are two main reasons. One is that teachers don't understand what they're doing.
Just trying to think of the other one. Let me put it a bit differently. I think rather than me say what I think it might be, the interesting thing that I've always found, and this is where I came up with, you know, even what I just said before, is if you find somebody that feels that, ask them what they
Okay, are. And what I hear is they'll tell me, I just cannot sell this stuff.
Okay, and then I would say somebody would need to look at, well, what do they mean by sell it? Are they going out and trying to, you know, convince people, here's this great thing called the technique, and by the way, here's a printout of this British Medical Journal study, and you should go and do it. And
yeah.
Then finding out, well, why do people do it or not do it because of those reasons? I mean, as opposed to if they're talking with somebody, first establishing, you know, does that person even have an issue that they want to solve? And if so, what is it? You know, a bit of curiosity, what is it? And then maybe helping somebody see it. This is always what I've just done. I've never been after particularly trying to sell it, but if there's somebody that's got a problem and we start chatting about it and I can help them maybe see another side of that problem they hadn't thought of and see if they're interested in playing around with it. And sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not. If they are, of course, we can set something up, and if they're not, well, that's okay. But again, I'm not the expert on this one because I've never actually had to make a practice. I think partly because of how I started the whole thing, I had a reputation through the teaching I did and through that big anatomy book I published, and work just came to me, and I never actually had to go and hustle it out.
Is there anything that I have not asked you about that I should ask you about?
Well, let's see, I have this big list here. No, I'm sure we could talk on about any number of subjects. But if you run out of questions...
Well, I have not run out of questions, but I think this was a good interview, so... I'm happy with what we've done.
Okay, well that's good. If what you're really asking me is, do I have any particular things I feel I want to squeeze in here?
Yes.
Then no, not particularly at the moment. Maybe for another time.
Okay, great.
When I think of them.
David, this was great. I really appreciate your time, and I've enjoyed talking with you.
Great. Well, thanks. I always have fun chatting about it all. Okay, Luke.
Okay, take care, David. Be well.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.